Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and am now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I am privileged to host Matthew Butler-Adam for a conversation on corporate education. Matt is the Managing Director of Duke Corporate Education, leading their activities in the UK and Europe. Prior to Duke, Matt worked in strategy consulting and M&A advisory at Bain & Company and Deloitte. Matt's educational background is in economics and education, including a master's in international education policy at Harvard and a master's in development economics at Oxford, where he was awarded the Luca Diagliano Prize for the best dissertation. Matt has also written a book titled Cracking Corporate. I first met Matt over a decade and a half ago. We studied undergrad together and we worked together for a few years. He has shaped the way that I see the bridge between academia and industry. And that bridge is really important in education. Matt, it's lovely to have you on. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks so much, Monde. I really appreciate it. I was just reflecting. I feel as though every time we talk, at least one of us learns something new. And most often we both learn something new. So I hope that'll happen today.
So do I, Matt. Yeah, before we get into corporate education and all of that, I'd love to just start with you first. So tell us a little bit about your journey. Where did you grow up and your family? And what was your path ultimately into education?
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah. So I grew up in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. My family lived very close to Durban's very big harbor, which I subsequently discovered growing up as the biggest in Africa and really makes Durban a real melting pot of different people from all over the world. And not totally dissimilar to you, I guess. My parents were in some different ways involved in education. My mom started off as a teacher at a high school and ended up lecturing at a university. And my father was I guess a little bit more involved in academic administration and ended up playing a role as a grant maker for education investments across the African continent. So for better or worse, I had a very strong education style influence throughout my upbringing.
That's great, Matt. And were you an only child? Do you have any siblings?
I've got a younger sister. She's a brilliant person. More socially aware than I am. And she spent a couple of years, I think almost 10 years, working on the boats in the Mediterranean. And she now lives with her partner in Nottingham here in England.
Okay, got it. So roots in South Africa and now based in England. And you've had quite a varied educational journey as well. Seemingly, it sounds like it's following in the footsteps of your mom and dad. So maybe just tell us about your schooling journey as well.
Yeah, sure. So I finished my pre-primary high school years in Durban. And that's when I left Durban. For various reasons, my family also left Durban and moved up to Johannesburg. I went down to the Cape. And that's where we met at the University of Cape Town. And I did a broad undergraduate degree, politics, philosophy and economics, which I really appreciated and I enjoyed economics, I think, in particular. And after doing a sort of undergraduate research paper, I was really inspired by that discipline and wanted to get more exposure to research opportunities. And that's what eventually over a couple of years led to me doing some postgrad programs, one in the UK and one in the US that you've mentioned. And I absolutely love them. They gave me the opportunity to, well, firstly, learn lots of new things through coursework, but start using those theoretical frameworks to ask new and interesting questions about the world around me.
That's great, Matt. And all through that journey as well, both the school journey and the working journey, you've managed to somehow find time to write a book. So what is your motivation for writing a book?
It's been a really interesting passion project that a friend of mine, Yusuf Amir, and I worked on for a couple of years. The reason we wrote this book and the way the conversation started is we came across each other in a management consulting environment, and we both reflected on the fact that we had had difficult experiences, at least, you know, in the early years of work, but they didn't seem to stop. We were always learning and pushing our boundaries and having to think about things in different ways. At the same time, we also reflected that we were both probably in fairly privileged positions. Like I think having parents involved in education is a huge advantage in life. We had good foundations and in theory were set up to be successful in the corporate environment. But we still found it really difficult, and we thought, it's probably extremely difficult for all sorts of people, given the very high levels of inequality in South Africa, but in other markets all over the world. Like the entry point into a big organization attracts, or it should attract, a very diverse group, and not everyone's going to have the same chance of succeeding. So what we wanted to do was try and synthesize some lessons from mistakes we've made, but also from talking to other people who we thought had been successful in their careers, so that it was a one-stop shop for people moving into the corporate space, where they could quickly read a few things and increase their chances of being successful when they started their new roles.
That's great, Matt. That's a lovely motivation for writing the book. And I know how much effort goes into a book, so it really must be a passion project. It reminds me actually a little bit of Hillbilly Elegy, if you've ever read the book, and the phase where he talks about ordering sparkling water at the table while he was studying at Yale, which was fascinating. And there's so many things that you just don't... they're a part of corporate life. It could be golf, it could be cycling, it could be whatever the case may be. And in reality, a lot of them are fairly elite activities. So it's wonderful that you're calling out the unsaid and helping people prepare for a successful career in corporate. You can have all the academic qualifications, but there's a whole lot of social side to succeeding in corporate. So maybe just if you can touch on a point or two from the book of the kinds of things that help young people that they should think about when they're entering the corporate workplace.
There are a few. Each chapter really is meant to focus on some thematic bit of advice. So there are a couple I could talk to. The first one is probably just about moving into the corporate space with some deliberate intentions. So having some goals and some greater purpose around the work you're doing. I think that's really important, because it means that you're working towards something. You're not taking every day as it comes, which you might maybe do as a university student, but you're actually sort of working towards something and thinking carefully about how the decisions you make, or the way you show up in meetings or when important decisions are made, is all slowly working towards some greater goal. We talk a little bit about ways you can organize your life and think about priorities and structure your time, again, which I think requires some really deliberate effort and may not immediately come naturally to everyone who's starting out in the working world. We talk a little bit about difficult interactions and conversations that you might come across. Big organizations, rightly so, attract a very diverse group of people. And if you haven't been exposed to that, you may not, as you say, easily navigate the appropriate corporate language for all the interactions that you're having on a day-to-day basis. And we get onto some higher order things around, like, values, which I think are really important for people to think about early on in their career, but become increasingly important when they get more senior and start taking on decision-making roles. So our view was that it's important to have some set of principles that offer some sort of ethical compass for navigating difficult and uncertain decisions. I'm not going to go into the details around that, but we suggest some frameworks to help people think through the consequences of the decisions they might make in a corporate setting.
That's great, Matt. That's great. And I've taken to giving the book to some of our interns in the office, so people who are young in their corporate career, and I'd encourage others as well to both read the book, and if there's any young people that they feel would benefit from it, to buy the book for them. So I think let's move on then to corporate education specifically. How would you define corporate education? And give me a sense, how big is this industry?
The way to think about the definition of the market, one framework might be who's the customer and what's the cost base like. When I think about the customer and who's buying the service, there are a few key attributes. So definitely it's a corporation or a large organization. It can be listed. It can be private. It could be a large nonprofit organization. The buyer, the person deciding to buy education or learning, is typically a very senior decision maker in the organization. So someone allocating resources. The end customer is an employee. It's an adult and it's someone who is employed. And those two things are important, because the fact that it's an adult means that we can lean on pedagogy, but there's a special area of pedagogy, andragogy, which is focused on the best ways to get adults to learn, which is a little bit different from the ways we might get young people to learn things. And the second thing is that they're employed. So the style of education and type of topics that come up on average are a little bit different to people who aren't in an employment setting. Size of the industry or the sector, different people have different views. So I'm not going to put a point estimate. Right now, there's a range of estimates that say the corporate education market could be between 100 and 300 billion. Analysts believe that...
300 billion what, Matt?
US dollars.
US dollars. Okay. Yeah, so this is a huge market.
Yeah. That it probably is going to grow to something like 500 to 600 billion by 2030. And I used to struggle. I still struggle with large numbers like that. So I need to put them into context. And by 2030, a lot of analysts have the total education sector market at around 10 trillion. Again, that could be debated, and their range is maybe at 6 to 10 trillion, again, USD. And if I compare those two data points in 2030, that would mean that of the total education sector, the corporate dimension is somewhere in the range of 5 to 10% of the total market. When I think about that, it resonates with me. It makes sense. But I'm sure analysts might have some different perspectives about the relative size and growth trajectories. But that's at least how I think about it. There's some other interesting data points if you wanted to do a bottom-up approach. There's a big human capital report that Deloitte produces almost every single year. And in that report, they estimate that, especially amongst large listed organizations, anywhere from 1 to 3% of total revenue is spent or invested in education through learning and development programs.
Okay. It's a huge market then, and it sounds like it's growing as well with some long-term tailwinds. There's some of the key nuggets that stood out for me then that differentiate corporate education specifically is it's an adult who's being taught, and it's an adult who is employed. And the payer is the company or the corporate, which itself could be listed or private. Okay. Let's make it tangible then. Let's talk about this. What are these big organizations wanting to learn about? Maybe give us some examples.
So yeah, imagine you're a big business and you are thinking about ways of upskilling or attracting talent. And the one thing to say about this is I think the underlying demand for this type of work is pretty resilient and will remain the case if we've got competitive markets. One is because offering education as part of your employee value proposition is really important to young talent, increasingly important. When people start work, they want to know that they're going to be invested in. So it's important for attracting young talent. It's also, by the way, important inside organizations. If they want to be competitive in complex markets, they want employees to be the best they can be, the best versions of themselves, and to add value in their organizations. And training and upskilling them is one way they can do that. So what are the type of things we're talking about, just to make it as tangible as possible? It includes graduate programs. You hire 200 new staff across a global business. You need to employ, or thousands sometimes, you need to spend some weeks or some months getting them up to speed about the company culture, about the objectives of the business, and certainly what they're going to do in their role. When you're promoting batches of people to be new managers or vice presidents, or senior leaders, you need to invest in some education to get them ready for the new role. But also you constantly need to be upskilling employees on the topics that matter in the market. I think we've all probably done cybersecurity training at some stage in our lives, sometimes more often than it feels necessary. That type of training is absolutely critical, and it's a part of the market. A couple of years ago, the big focus of corporate training was around sustainability and ESG. We've seen some declines around investment on that type of training, but there's a new theme that's emerged, and that's artificial intelligence. Organizations are deeply motivated not to train employees on the technical aspects of artificial intelligence, but to get them up to speed about how they might deploy it in a way that means they aren't going to be left behind. So those are the type of trainings. I've mentioned a few. I could say that this market has everything to do with whenever a business wants to teach its employees something new or different. The one little nuance I'm going to say about that, and maybe, you know, this is something you might ask me, is they've got an important decision to make. They might do that in-house, or they might ask for a partner to do it for them, or they might have some sort of hybrid model where they've got team members inside who play some role, and they're bringing in a set of providers to try and offer a full value proposition. But all of that, whether it's provided in-house, whether it's brought from a vendor, as a part of the market because it's paid for in some way or other.
Understood. Well,
I should say one other thing, which is a really important new trend that I would include in this market, is that a lot of organizations are offering to their employees libraries of content and giving them a small wallet to make decisions about what short certificates or programs they'd like to invest in. So it's not uncommon to say, you're allowed to spend every year $1,000 on upskilling yourself from this library of content. So that's just another example of the way people are bringing learning into these corporate organizations.
Sounds like a very diverse industry as well. There's many different levels of corporate training. So if I put where I've experienced this and what you're discussing with cybersecurity, et cetera, is I've served on a few boards, corporate boards, and there's a lot of board training that happens pretty much every year. There'll be a cycle. And I have noticed it goes in waves. So we've just come out of the cybersecurity wave, and now we're going into the AI wave. So I 100% identify with what you're saying. And that's just one segment of this, as you said. There'll be middle management, there'll be so many different layers. And similarly, with the short courses that you can choose from, I have, prior in my career, done a short course by a company called Get Smarter, which is owned by a listed business called 2U. So I have seen these firsthand. Let's move on then. So give me some of the verticals within this industry. It's a very diverse market, lots of different parts to it. So what are some of the verticals, and who are some of the companies or players in there?
Yeah. Great question. And again, different people are going to slice and dice the market in different ways. There's definitely a group who do it sort of by content. So it's like there's a market inside corporate for sustainability, or there's a market inside corporate for AI, or there's a market inside corporate for broad leadership based interventions. That's one way of thinking about it. There are other ways, you know, we could think about regions. We could think about all sorts of other variables. I'm going to describe three segments that are useful for me in the work I do when I think about the market. And the first of those is what I would describe as off-the-shelf scale offerings for employees. So that's to the point you had just raised. Organizations are building, typically through partners, libraries of content that people can click through at any point in time. It can be real time, that allows them to learn stuff on the job. This is typically being provided by large edtechs. So 2U, who own edX and Get Smarter, is one example. Coursera, Udemy, FutureLearn, LinkedIn Learning, and there are many more. I would describe the sector as slightly lower margin, huge scale, huge potential. And if I think about the long-term trajectory of this sector, I kind of expect it to converge to some sort of like library of libraries play, where you just want to get the best of everything consolidated in one place, and there's some sort of like subscription fee around it. The second segment I would talk about is also off the shelf. So it's programmatic, it's predefined, but these I would describe as more like premium learning experiences. So it's a course that's already built in the same way that the first set of content is already built, it exists, but it's a premium experience, and it's not just an online clicking through, it's an in-person session or going to a campus. So the classic example of this is our offerings inside business schools, which are some really truly world-class offerings. And very often the classic example is something like an advanced management program, and it's 2 weeks or 6 months. And what an organization will do is say, I want to fund 15 of my employees to go to the West Coast of the United States, to go to, I don't know, any old university there. I don't know what a good one is, maybe Stanford. And you spend some time on the campus over there and you get some education and you come back, right? And it's a program that exists. Everyone who goes through it is going through the same program. It's a premium experience. You get to interact with world-class faculty on the cutting edge of research. But it's existing, it's pre-designed. Relative to some other segments, I'd say it's a moderate margin business, moderate scale, right? It's quite replicable. You can keep doing the same thing over and over again. You refresh it every couple of years, maybe. And to win in that market, reputation and prestige are absolutely critical. And then the third segment I talk about, and the one I'm most familiar with, is what I would call custom or bespoke built educational experiences. These are experiences where a big organization works in conjunction with a partner to co-create something that is bespoke built for the needs of the participants inside the context of the organization. A few organizations work in this space. It's typically like some boutique consulting firms. It is business schools. Business schools sometimes have small teams who are focused on these type of customized experiences. And there are a few other players. And this type of work typically has three phases, just to bring it to life. It's got a diagnostic and design phase that is working in conjunction with an education provider, trying to agree and understand what the learning objectives should be. And that very often requires interviews or surveys with employees, senior managers. What is it you actually want to achieve? And how can we make the case that this is tied to your strategy as an organization? So it's not learning just for the sake of learning. It's learning to help the organization achieve its strategic direction. And the big differentiator for that phase of the work is which partner organization can listen and understand best to the problem that is trying to be solved. The second phase in this segment is the delivery of the work, like execution of the program. I would say the most important differentiators there are things like the quality of the program itself and your agility to make real-time changes when you're getting feedback from participants or senior stakeholders. And the third and final phase, which actually starts at the beginning, is thinking about impact measurements and the influence on the long term of the organization. And my view on the differentiator for that phase is who's good at tracking data, but who's also honest about the type of impact that you can actually achieve with a program like this, and honest about what you maybe can't achieve. That's how I describe the verticals, and a little bit more detail on the final one, like the custom segment that I'm more familiar with.
Okay, that's really helpful. That's a wonderful way to think about it. So three categories, and off the shelf, which is often delivered distance or online, and that has very large scale, or a programmatic, but it's in person. And there, the things that come to mind when you were speaking is the Harvard Advanced Management Program, or they've got one at Stanford, and et cetera. And then the final one you mentioned, the custom built educational programs. So that's a very helpful framing. And as I think about this, there's already $1 billion plus businesses in these various verticals that you mentioned. Some of the names you mentioned there, Coursera, that's listed, New York Stock Exchange, $1.3 billion market cap. Udemy, you mentioned as well, listed on the NASDAQ, $1.4 billion market cap. So I think what's clear is here in corporate education and in the various verticals, it is already an investable sector at a reasonable scale.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk then a little bit about the benefits or the return on investment. Let's take the custom, because that's where you spend most of your time, the custom made courses. How do the people on the other side, be they the employees or the corporate itself, how do they think about the return on this investment that they put into education?
So I've seen a few different approaches to this. What I think is a good approach is to have a set of different metrics or variables that you're tracking over time, and that they should cover different parts of the business. And I'll give a few examples. I think they need to start absolutely with basic input metrics. How much time are people spending learning? Like, what are the man hours? What's the engagement like? Still on an individual level, what are the perceptions and reactions of people going through a program? I'm remain a fan of Net Promoter Score, and I think it's important to ask people if they'd recommend learning experiences and get immediate insights from those type of responses, as well as interacting with groups of learners and focus groups once they've been through an experience. But it also includes things like individual or team performance metrics, their reviews, feedback from managers, organizational health index surveys, culture surveys that are gauging the sentiment or leadership sensibilities of groups who have been through programs, retention rates, and how that relates, of course, to churn, promotion rates, whether people who have been in programs are, as we hope, filling a leadership pipeline. And finally, if we've been able to do a thoughtful bit of project work that's related to strategy, very often we can attribute new product launches to some revenue upside or some cost-saving initiatives if there's been significant and meaningful project work as a part of the program. So I think it's important for organizations to pick the metrics they care about and to track them over time, not to track 100 different metrics, to probably pick the 5 or 6 that matter most to them and be really intentional about keeping an eye on those, and not trying to attribute everything that's going on in the organization to one single program, because that's a trap I think people sometimes fall into.
Okay, got it. I'm on my last question then on corporate education, Matt, which is around the social impact. How do you think about the social impact of the work you do?
Yeah, great question. I mean, a few people have been talking about this Edelman Trust Survey or Trust Barometer that's gone out. It's had a really interesting result. I think it's a change from some historical outcomes, which is that businesses, the private sector, is more trusted than the media, and it's more trusted than governments. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about, because it means that corporates and the private sector have a really important role to play in society, and the impact and consequences on the world around us. So I think through corporate education work, you can have a really positive and strong influence on the way leaders are thinking about their organization's impact in the market. And I think businesses absolutely have to be a force for good. We try and build principles and values into the work we do whenever we have the opportunity. We also have the luxury of working with partners who we truly believe are bought into positive societal change. And we won't work with partners if we've got the sense that they aren't moving in the right direction for making the world a better place. We also have the really privileged opportunity, and anyone in the sector has the privileged opportunity, to think about their offerings and how they show up. And maybe I'll give you one super simple example. Very often corporate teams like experiences, immersive experiences where they can do something together. And building a musical experience, or building a song, or creating a piece of music is one of those. So it's really good for team building, and it's kind of fun. Now, we could do that by partnering with some professional musicians and paying them lots of money and, getting everyone to have a fun time. But every instance we have an opportunity like that, we partner with an NPO, which we do at least in London. And the one we've partnered with in London is an inner city organization that gives young kids who have some musical talent but no access to any infrastructure or studio facilities the opportunity to train world-class instruments or train vocally in world-class studios. And so we do all of our experiences like that with young inner city kids, and bring them into corporate partnerships. So that's on the margin, but we look for opportunities as often as possible to do our work in the most impactful and meaningful way on the small scale. And the impact we want to have on the leaders is as a multiplier, because they're big decision makers. And if they make more often than not the right decisions, we think we can have a really big impact on the world around us. So it's a huge, huge opportunity to have a good impact.
That's great, Matt. Thank you so much for giving me this insight into corporate education, which I think within the overall education sector, if you think of ed tech, preschool, school, primary and secondary education, university, I think this is a slightly overlooked sector. This doesn't get as much airtime either in the investment world or just in education generally. So thanks for giving me a good tour of it. Let's move on then to educational investment decisions. So your sector, corporate education, it's unlike K-12 education, you know, primary and secondary schooling. In most countries, including where I am right now, kids have to attend primary and secondary school. It's required by law. There's government behind it, etc. But by the time I'm hitting the ages where I'm relevant for corporate education, your sector, maybe I'm in my 30s, I'm in my 40s, I'm in my 50s, by then there's no requirement. There's no legal requirement for me to continue education. And yet, despite there being a known requirement, we're still seeing that over the last 50, 60 years, there's been a huge shift in people spending more time and more money on education. So let's start there. What does the research say? Why are people investing so much more time and so much more money into education?
The long and short of it is that in the last 50, 60 years, there's been a huge amounts of academic research that's pretty good, pretty rigorous, that's made the case for educational investments. So this type of research really took off in the 50s and 60s. And the two people who were really driving this concept of human capital, why it was important, were Gary Becker and another guy, Jacob Mincer. And basically, there have now been thousands of studies on the impact of education in all sorts of different respects. And the headline takeaway is that inside countries, education, human capital investments typically describe about 30% of the variation of different economic outcomes. That's pretty large. And that between nations, most economists say it's like probably describes about 50% of the differences of economic outcomes of nations. So there's some theory behind that, some big statistical testing or whatever, but the point is that there's now a really big body of research. What I would say is like a really interesting thing to think about and probably really important for this moment in time as well. It may sound obvious that we should invest in education, but it's not always been the case. And there are different political climates and moments in history where people move away from education. So in the 60s, at the time this type of academic research was being pursued, there was a big government-funded study in the United States called the Coleman Report, which was very long and not very clear. But a lot of the suggestions there were that schooling and education weren't actually all that important. That things like parental influence or the community environment were going to be the big drivers of economic outcomes for young people. It's not to say that that's not true, but the report was signaling that we should care a little bit less about schooling and educational investments. Now, that all the evidence suggests we should care about education greatly. The reason I say there are important moments in time is that I actually think right now we're at another important moment in time where it's very good for us to have all the evidence to suggest the importance of education globally.
That's wonderful, Matt. And there's clearly a lot of depth there. Two things that spring to mind. One is in the social sciences, there's always so many factors that impact any given question that you're looking at. If you're looking at what is the impact of education, as you touch on, you're going to get a lot of confounding variables like the influence of the parents, the influence of the community, a range of other things that can be correlated with how educated someone is. And isolating for that variable of education is actually a really, really challenging thing to do. The second thing that comes to mind is academia is in a sense funny in some ways, because it can have this impact where people do a lot of research over multiple decades and the ultimate insight at the end sounds really simple. If I were to drill down on what you've said to me, it's that we have quite reliable evidence that more education results in better economic outcomes for individuals and their families, which at the heart, if I were to just say that statement, that would sound very simple. But the level of rigor that's required is, you know, decades of work from some of the best economists and social scientists around the world. So thanks for sharing that. I'm keen to double click on some of those returns. So you've said that people earn more both at an individual level and when you look at it within countries and across different countries as well. Let's talk about those returns. How rigorous are these? Do we have some estimates for what they are?
As you rightly point out, like, estimating some of these returns is difficult. And the most famous example of, like, say, correlation or causation is around, say, ability bias. So maybe it's not the amount of education someone has. Maybe it's just they've got this inherent ability and that's correlated with education. We can't measure inherent ability. So maybe that's what's driving the returns. The short answer is that most econometricians have now invested in some really good statistical techniques to help, as you say, isolate the effect. And sometimes that's called instrumental variable approach or regression discontinuity. Sometimes they're actually doing experiments like randomized control trials to try and isolate effects. And don't need to go into the body of that research, but there's so much evidence now that, like, the International Labour Organization and some of its economists have done some meta studies that bring in all of these different statistical research approaches from all over the world. And they've done one of these that brings in research from 165 different countries. And basically the net result is that on average, and I know averages sometimes can be dangerous, but on average, the return for one additional year's worth of education in some formal institution is about 10%. So to make that practical, if you were to spend 4 years in a university degree, that would be 10% for each of the 4 years. And the expectation would be that that investment would increase your potential income compared to someone who didn't do that degree by 40%. And that's a really large, like, meaningful economic impact. And that's just the private return, right? There are all sorts of other returns that might be positive externalities on society, or just intrinsic returns for the individual from the learning process that are even harder to estimate. So some of these returns are, I would describe as underestimates. When I say averages are dangerous, it's because the returns do vary, and they vary on a number of factors. So they vary by region, for example. And one interesting thing that came out of this huge meta study is that the returns from a regional perspective are actually the highest in sub-Saharan Africa on average. So I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. They're even higher for women across the board. So on average across the globe. So when women spend more time in education, the returns to them are higher. And in particular for women in sub-Saharan Africa. So the highest returns for educational investment around the world are typically for women in sub-Saharan Africa. And they vary on other dimensions, like also the phase of education. So it used to be the case that everybody thought that earlier investment in education, so when someone's very young, gave you the biggest return on your investment. But there's a lot of new research that suggests that that's not entirely true. Yes, you do get some pretty high returns for early investment, but that equivalently high and sometimes even higher returns come much later. So post high school, when you get into tertiary institutions and adult learning, that's when you start to see some really high returns again. So it's like, it's kind of like the shallow U curve. The returns are always pretty large, but they're highest at the beginning and highest again right at the end.
That is very interesting. And actually, it goes counter to what I intuitively thought, which was that there'd be some sort of diminishing returns, that you'd get, you know, a lot of value from your primary education, from your secondary education and the early part of your higher education. But by the time I'm doing, you know, short course number six in my employment, I didn't think that that would still be, yielding a lot of value. So that's really fascinating to hear. The other thing that's fascinating to hear there is that the returns or the impact is highest amongst, well, the group you went to was sub-Saharan African females. And the reason that's so topical for me, I was actually, my daughter, Unkanyezi, this week had an oral at school. And her topic that she was speaking about was Malala Yousafzai. So I spent part of my day listening to, or part of my week at least, listening to her prepare multiple times, talking about girls' education. So that's wonderful to hear that the academic research also supports it and those increased returns. Let me test you a little bit on what you're saying, Matt. You're talking primarily about human capital theory, which is basically that if you invest more in education, you're investing more in your human capital, and that results in better returns for you later in life, so better outcomes for you and your family. But, you know, I've heard also of the signaling theory, if I think back to my educational days, which, you know, if I were to go to the extreme, it would make the case that the youngster who has studied, let's say, history at Cambridge and then goes in to work at Goldman Sachs in their investment banking division, surely it's not the stuff they learned in history that's, or in their history degree, that's getting them into a job in investment banking and working in finance. So that would suggest that there's some other effect aside from just the human capital, some sort of signal that the education is providing. What's your counter to that?
This gets to the heart of some of the biggest debates in the prioritization of education. And I'm not sure that the answer is fully resolved. If I think the case for the example you've shared, so the history student who makes it in investment banking, people who will make the case for it's caused by the education itself are going to lean on things that would have been useful in that degree, like critical thinking skills or problem solving, that even though not directly relevant for financial decision making, can definitely be applied in other settings to help people solve problems or make good decisions. All of that said, I think one way to think about it is that the causal root of education has a few facets to it. One of those might be the skills that you learn, the things you learn and that you can apply that make you more productive and effective in the labor market. They might also, another mechanism might be the signaling, as you point out, that you have proven that you can kind of do something that requires some commitment and you get a certificate and a piece of paper. And there's another one that's probably also quite important, and that's a networking effect. So maybe going into these prestigious institutions introduces you to people and a network that gives you better chances of getting into jobs and getting promotions down the line. I'm not going to perfectly resolve it. I'm going to share one quick study, which I think is illuminating on the topic. And this is an example of a quasi-experimental approach. So what a couple of economists did is they looked at a cohort of school leavers. And let's say, for example, that at the end of high school, in this setting, there's a pass grade of 50. So you have to get 50% to actually get a certificate at the end of year 12 that says, I finished high school. And what they did is they focused in on people who were just above and below that cutoff point. So, right, there are people who are scoring 50 or 51 or 52 or 53 who just scrape over the line, right? And then there's another group of people who get 47, 48, 49. They've just missed the cutoff, right? So this is an interesting group of people because they've both had the same number of years of schooling, right? They've had 12 full years of schooling, but there's a bunch who get the certificate, the signaling device, and then there's a bunch who don't get the signaling device, right? Because they've done the 12 years, but they haven't passed. And what they looked at were the economic returns of those two smaller populations in the long run. And the really interesting insight is that for the group who just got over the line, the short-term consequences were quite clear. They were more likely to get into university, obviously. But controlling for additional education attainment, 10 years later, there was no significant difference in the income levels of those individuals. So that's one study that signals, excuse the pun, that signaling may not be as important as we think it is. Not to say it's never important, but there's some evidence that the skills and stuff you learn is definitely driving the outcomes.
That's great. I was being intentionally a bit cheeky when I gave the example of the history major and the role at Goldman Sachs. And a point that you brought across, which I think is 100% correct, there's a lot more to human capital than just the technical side of what you learn. In most careers, there's a lot more nuance and a lot more that goes into human capital. How to interact with people, how to manage people, how to get the best out of them. There's just so many. How to learn, how to have a mentor, all of it. So much that goes into human capital. And when human capital is broadly defined, I think it's an excellent model for explaining some of the value of education. Right. So it's clear then the academic research says, you know, over, you know, 50, 60 years worth of research across all these different countries says more or less the same thing. And how well known is this by the people that actually make the decision of whether to invest more in education? At school level, that will really be the student and the parents. But in your world, in the corporate education world, that it might be a learning and development professional or something of the like?
Yeah, great question. I'm not sure what the answer is. My hypothesis is that it's like a lot of academic research. It's not as accessible as it should be, and that not every decision maker who's thinking about education knows the detail of what these returns look like. This evidence, luckily, has massively influenced public policy. So the reason, and your distinction about compulsory or voluntary, the fact that education's compulsory up until certain ages, I think is great. I think that's the state saying, this is a no-brainer investment. Like, we want our people, our citizens, to be educated because we know that the returns are so significant. And I'm not sure if individuals were always left to make that decision on their own, if they'd make that decision. So I think there's work to be done to continue making the case for these type of returns. There's one very recent study which actually looked at this exact question. It's like, what are the returns for postgraduate education? What are the actual returns for which there's some evidence? And we asked young people who are making the decision to invest in, say, a master's degree or not, what they think the returns are, what their perceptions of these returns are. And this is a study by a few Oxford economists that came out 2 or 3 years ago, and they found quite a big gap. So these students underestimated the returns. And the really, in my opinion, saddening thing is that the biggest descriptor of the gap, of that perception versus reality gap in returns, was whether or not someone was a first generation student. And first generation students massively underestimate the returns to, in this case, postgraduate study. And that's, I say that's worrying because it reinforces a cycle in which people who have gone to university before will end up doing more and more university, and people who haven't or in the first time don't fully realize their potential. So that's maybe for a longer conversation. But the end of all of this academic research and this discussion for me is just like really important, because it says education matters. It matters throughout your life. There are great private returns. There's public policy and investment in making sure we get educated. And if anything, I would still make the case that we're underinvested in education when I think about the full periods through which we can be involved in the education cycle.
That's great, Matt. I appreciate that. You've geeked out here, and I know you love the academia. And I mentioned up front that one of the things I've had from you is the bridge between academia and industry. And I always found that in our conversations. I do appreciate that. And the key message really that I take from what you've said, is that people are spending more time and more money in education, and they're investing more in it. And that's because it is improving the quality of their lives. So that's at multiple stages. We've had, if I look over the last 60 years, the percentage of the world adult population with some secondary education went from, I think it was 13 to 50%. And with some tertiary education went from 2 to 14. So we've come a really, really long way, but there's also still so far to go if you look at this really on a global level. And it does then bode positively for your industry, which is corporate education, if people are studying more and more as they go along. I'm going to ask now my concluding question, which I have the same concluding question that I asked to all our guests, and it's actually my favorite question. And that is, tell us about your favorite teacher or educator.
So the one example I will give is a woman who was the head of the economics department at the University of Cape Town. She occupies now a professorial role in that team, Justine Burns. She was great. She was the first academic I interacted with where I was doing some independent research. And I had a crazy idea. I had the type of idea that I guess even academics who maybe are on the liberal side of things would have said, don't do it. It's too risky. It's whatever. I appreciated that she, the moment I said it, she said, that is, I love it. That's cutting edge. That's new. That's different. It's creative. And I'm so appreciative of that. And she, by the way, she equipped me with all the methodological tools I needed to do a good research project. So she was technically excellent, but she was also brave and she allowed me to be brave. And I don't think I would have done most of the other bits of research I've done if I hadn't been encouraged to do something new and different and interesting. So she was great for that. And then the other person I'm going to mention was not a formal faculty or lecturer or professor or someone. It was a peer in one of the master's degrees I did. It was somebody who was so truly engaged in what they were studying that I spent so much time with this person. It's a guy called Lauren Yannis, who's now works in the civil service here in the UK. But he really wanted to understand the deep technical modeling underneath some of the really difficult econometrics we were studying. And I spent so many hours with him. I was inspired by his real desire to get to the bottom of the technical side of it. And I truly learned so much by being with him when he was figuring stuff out. And the reason I wanted to share the example is because I think you can learn so much from your peers, and you should never discount your peers as a source of learning, even when you're in formal education settings. He was probably one of the most impactful people in that program, more so than a, say, professor at a great university. So yeah, those are the two that stand out for me.
That's a lovely way to end off, Matt. And the peer learning is a wonderful topic, because I mentioned right up front here that you've shaped the way that I see the bridge between academia and industry. I think our listeners would have heard over the course of this conversation that the way you see the world is fundamentally got to be grounded in evidence. And then everything else you add on top of that, which is quite unusual. You don't find that, I don't find it that much in the world. So I appreciate the impact you've had on me in shaping my view in the bridge between academia and industry. And I've learned a lot from you. And thanks for the discussion today. I think you gave a very good overview of corporate education and its academic underpinnings as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing you soon in the UK, and I know you're going to be a father soon, so all the best for that.
Yeah, and I'm very glad we're expecting a girl. So if the evidence is correct, the returns to her educational investments will be extremely high. So it's great news. And thank you for having me. I learned a lot from this session as well.